Fall is all about cozy comforts, but when you're prioritizing your health, it's easy to feel like you're missing out. With Hero Bread, you can enjoy all your fall favorites because they're made with Hero Bread sliced bread loaves, tortillas, bagels, dinner rolls, and more. Try their all new Hero Noodles with 12 grams of protein and just 80 calories. So skip replacing every carb with cauliflower and indulge in your breakfast, lunch, and dinnertime favorites while still hitting your goals. From breakfast bagels and meal prepped enchiladas, to mouth-watering burgers and cheesy noodles. You won't believe Hero Bread's options have 0 to 5 grams net carbs and are high fiber from the taste and texture. They've even got small batch drops of indulgent favorites like the popular Hero Croissant. And right now, Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code FALL25 at checkout. That's FALL25 at HERO.CO. All figures are per serving of Hero Bread. Contains 2 to 18 grams of fat per serving. See the product nutrition panels on hero.co for more information.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae,
proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world all around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, and rating, and letting people know about the show. We really appreciate it, and it's so great to hear that the show continues to grow. So thank you very much. Coming up on this week's program, we're going to talk about forgotten childhood memories and how an interesting tweak on how you see yourself may help you remember things you've long forgotten. If you'd like to get in touch with the podcast, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter. We're at Newstalk Science. We get to all of those comments at the end of the pod. First, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news, and we're joined by Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland and from DCU, Dr. Shelley Brady. You're both very welcome. Our first story has to do with melatonin. And this is of great interest to me because in our household, we have someone who's really struggling to sleep, and melatonin was seen as a bit of a godsend. What is going on here? What is melatonin?
Yes. So melatonin, well, it's a hormone that we naturally make. It's made in the pineal gland in our brain. And what happens is the level of melatonin in your body goes up at night. So it's sort of a sleep messenger. It nudges your body into going to sleep. And then the level drops during the night as you're sleeping. And as when you have lower levels in the morning, then that helps you wake up. But as you say, where people make synthetic melatonin, you can buy it over the counter, particularly in the US if people have traveled, and often people will pick it up for jet lag, because it can help reset that body clock. And as you say, it's really seen as sort of a mimic of our natural hormone and something that's totally safe. And it's sometimes also prescribed for people with insomnia. And this is a preliminary study, and it's a look back study at data, and it was presented at the American Heart Association's annual meeting that's taking place at the moment. And what the research team wanted to look into was whether long-term use of melatonin could influence your risk of heart failure. So what they did was there's a global research network, which is a big database of medical records where it's anonymized. And they found in there a huge number of patients, so 65,000 patients. And all of these patients had been diagnosed with chronic insomnia, and they had been on melatonin for at least a year. And then they found a control group, the same number of people. They also had insomnia, but they'd never used melatonin according to their medical records. And they excluded from both groups anyone who had any history of heart failure. And their results are quite interesting, because when they looked at that five-year period, they found that there was nearly double the risk of getting a heart failure diagnosis in the group that was taking melatonin. Now, obviously, it's not massive risk, but I mean, the risk goes from about nearly 3% to nearly 5% in the group.
That is significant, for sure.
Yeah, no, it is very significant. They also found there was 3.5 times higher risk of being hospitalized for heart failure. Yeah, so the heart failure was more severe in those that were taking the melatonin. And they just found, and there was also nearly double the risk of just dying from any cause at all. So as you say, these are kind of stark results, and people will probably see them in headlines because melatonin is so easily accessible. I mean, I guess the word of caution attached to it is it is retrospective, it's observational, it's not a randomized controlled trial, and there's lots of bits of data that are missing. So one thing we don't know is how severe the insomnia was. And of course, you'd have to guess that if people were going to their doctor and getting prescribed melatonin, these are the people who are suffering the most from lack of sleep. And of course, we know that lack of sleep has huge impacts on lots of different aspects
and
of our health.
Stress, for sure, yeah.
Stress, all of that.
And stress will have a knock-on factor on heart failure and heart stress. And of course, that's, as you say, that's why people would get treatment for it. I bought some yesterday. Literally yesterday, I was in Boston and I bought some melatonin for this exact reason. I hadn't read the study yet. In America, I think it's very much seen as just one of those things you can, if you can't sleep, you can take one of these. They're gums, they're little jellies you can take. And the jellies contain 10 milligrams for the stronger dose of melatonin. So yeah, I suppose what you're saying is it's difficult to know whether or not just the insomnia led to those problems or not. But it's really interesting because of the accessibility and this being a very prevalent problem, seemingly increasingly in the modern world, that people are struggling with sleep.
Yeah, and look, it's interesting to think about popping pills in general. I mean, the whole acetaminophen debate, you know, that was kicked off by Trump, and this idea, oh, it's easy to take a paracetamol as well. There's no harm with anything. And I think, you know, it's important to think, well, there could be. We don't necessarily fully know everything. And there's probably side effects with anything that you take. And on the flip side of that is when you think about supplements and things, there's a lot of them there's no robust evidence that they're doing us any good. I mean, there are certainly some, and people should always follow the advice that they're getting from medics. But, you know, I think it's just also about thinking twice before you're popping a pill.
Okay. Our second story, I suppose, is kind of a good story and kind of a worrying story. It's to do with bacteria in our oceans, Shelley.
Yeah, this story, it's quite incredible, really. And it's all about the discovery of a bacteria with plastic eating capabilities. And it's in the depths of the ocean. And like you say, it's proof once again that nature keeps finding ways to fix problems that we are creating as humans. So researchers have discovered marine microbes with the ability to break down, I'm going to try and pronounce this now, polyethylene terephthalate or PET plastic. And that's the kind of plastic that's used in bottles and many fabrics. And these microbes that they've discovered carry special enzymes, and it's identified by a molecular fingerprint known as the M5 motif. And the presence of this motif signals that the enzyme is genuinely effective at degrading PET. So the researchers suggest that the bacteria have evolved this ability because in nutrient poor, deep ocean, plastic has become a novel source of carbon. So in other words, shamefully, nature is adapting to human pollution. What's remarkable, I think, about it is it's widespread now, Jonathan. It's the study found that these enzymes are in nearly 80% of more than 400 ocean samples that were collected worldwide. And that ranged from the surface waters that are laced with the floating plastics right down to the depths of 2 kilometers.
Okay, a lot to unpack there. And enzymes in and of themselves are not organisms, though, right? So these are enzymes found in bacteria?
Within bacteria. So it's bacteria using specialist enzymes.
Right.
So the study emphasizes that this is not a solution to our pollution issues.
Just throw all our plastic in the ocean.
Yeah, exactly.
People.
So the breakdown process is really slow, and it's far too slow to keep pace with the massive volumes of plastics that are entering our oceans. And where they see the real potential, and the good news side of it, I suppose, is that it could help us on land. So by studying these enzymes and this M5 motif, there's hope to maybe engineer more efficient versions that could be used in recycling plants or maybe even in our own homes in the future.
Yeah, so we've talked in this program before about microbes that are able to digest plastic into component parts, or at least not forever materials, mm-hmm. which is very useful. Whether or not we can learn from these particular different types of microbes and do it more efficiently is certainly a question. And everything that we make did come from natural components. So, you know, theoretically, enough energy, enough pressure, or enough cleverness, we can actually break them back down in theory, but really interesting to see that this is just something that the oceans have evolved this bacterium because their life cycle is so short. They're like, there's no food left, let's just make this food, which is through natural selection, which is really cool in a way.
So it's a natural mechanism. It's evolving from an unnatural source, But being able to break down the plastics would be a game changer. And if these enzymes can be harnessed, who knows? Like you said, maybe we can turn them into something biodegradable or at least more manageable.
Okay, our third story, Ruth, is to do with exclamation marks. What is this all about?
Thanks for that amazing intro, Jonathan. I'm getting some excitement into my voice. So yeah, this is a study that was conducted by researchers in the US and it was published in the Journal of Experimental Social Psychology. And they were trying to look into our perceptions and use of exclamation marks and what they say about us and our communication. And they were really particularly looking into gender as one of the aspects that they were looking at. So they did actually five different studies and they either used participants that were paid through this online platform called Prolific, which is a platform where people can sign up to participate in behavioral and social science studies. And they had university students that were also involved. And they had kind of between 200 and 600 people in each group for every experiment. So the first study that they did was they sent the participants different emails. Some of them had more exclamation marks, some of them had less. And they asked them to infer, was the email sent by a man or a woman? And studies with emails with more exclamation marks were more likely to be perceived as having been sent by a woman. The second study, they asked participants which messages they preferred when they sent them a message that had more exclamation marks or fewer. And women were more likely to choose the messages with exclamation marks and to perceive them as more normal and more warm. Whereas both groups, men and women, men didn't see it as normal to use a lot of exclamation marks. And also they had some negative judgments, including that the sender had a lower level of analytical capability or competence. Then in the last two studies, they actually asked people to assess their own use of exclamation marks. So this was using university students. They got them to think about their own use in texts, in group chat, in emails. Women reported using more, but they also reported a great consciousness about thinking about using them. They believed they used too many. And they also were trying to constantly balance this needing to feel that there was warmth in their communication, but also being aware that there could be negative implications from the exclamation marks. And in fact, they saw those negatives when they reviewed emails with exclamation marks in them. They saw those negativities. They perceived that the sender had less power. And you know potentially even was less competent. So the last study then asked participants to look into all of those things. You know, what were the impressions created and what did it say about the sender and themselves? So it's a kind of interesting little study for anyone who sat there grappling with, should I use an emoji? Should I use an exclamation mark in that email to my boss? And the answer is, maybe you should, maybe you shouldn't. You kind of have to balance up. Do you want to put forward that sense of warmth of enthusiasm and risk, maybe being seen as a bit less serious or less capable?
Yeah, I think it's very dangerous to, you know, to just make assumptions or you know, just assume that men communicate one way or women communicate another way. But I'm always, when I think about how men and women communicate differently sometimes, I always go back to this time where I was walking down the street and I was with my wife and I got a text from a friend who asked, do you want to play football this Thursday at 8 p.m.? And I just said, no, sorry. And I sent it to him. And Dara was like, oh God, you really don't like that guy. And I said, what? And we had this conversation. And she said, well, if I received that, I would have said, oh, thank you so much for the invitation. That is really kind of you. You know, absolutely would. But my mother is actually sick and I've got to go visit her. And I was like, you would put all of that into a text. She was like, absolutely. Otherwise, that person would hate me. And I thought it was so funny because I got a thumbs up back from the guy, you know, and he just went, he's just trying to find someone to play football. And so just, you know, while everyone is different and labeling people as being serious or not serious is kind of dangerous. I think, you know, the nuances of communication are always really interesting to me.
Yeah.
Okay. Our final story, Shelley, has to do with super recognizers. And we did a really interesting piece on this a few years back because I had no idea there were super recognizers. So remind our audience, please.
Well, it turns out I'm not one because I did the test online that the University of New South Wales has, where they expose you to 20 faces for a number of seconds. And then you have to try and match them afterwards to other pictures of the same individual, perhaps in different positions and in different lighting. So some people are just great at recognizing faces or remembering people they've met from years ago. And now science has a name for it, super recognizers. And this study has shed light on why some people are really good at it and also what it might teach us about artificial intelligence. So in this particular study, they had 37 super recognizers and then 68 people like me with typical face recognition skills and had their eye movements tracked while they were looking at faces. And then what the team did was they reconstructed what these people actually saw. So their so-called retinal information, and they fed that into deep neural network models trained for face recognition. So in essence, they reconstructed the actual visual information that each person had seen through their own eyes. And their key finding was, it's not just that super recognizers look at more of a face, it's that they look at better parts of a face. So they pick regions that carry more identity clues. And even when both groups saw the same total amount of information, it was fed to the AI model. The AI model was better at recognizing faces using the data from the super recognizers. So quality of visual input matters more than quantity.
Wow. Okay, that's really interesting. And I guess those things might be, you know, relationship of eyes or shape of lips, or did it say?
It didn't go into any of that, which was a little bit disappointing, actually. I was looking forward to seeing, okay, what could I maybe try and train myself to do to become a super recognizer? But they're sort of saying, look, it's a genetic thing. It's not something that we can learn easily. And yeah, you might have a job like a teacher or in the guards where you're having to recognize people more frequently, and that can help train you a little bit to become better. But in general, they think it's more genetic. It's rooted in biology, and it's not something that you can easily train.
Yeah, I wonder if there's a higher proportion of super recognizers in politicians, because that's such a famous skill to be a politician, that you can remember people that you've met in any situation.
No.
Yeah, or have.
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, go on, Shelley.
No, I was going to say, or have good staff helping you remember.
Wow.
That's right. Yeah, whispering into your ear, that is Tom. Yeah. You met him last week at a dinner. I wish I had one of those, because I'm the worst at this. And my brain doesn't just go, hey, how's it going? It always just picks a name and just randomly says it at people. Dave. No, Jeremy. Oh, sorry. Yes. And I always, as soon as I say, that's not his name. That's not his name. This is a voice in my head. I always get it wrong. And I actually got it wrong this morning. Great to have you on again, and Dr. Shelley Brady and Dr. Ruth Freeman. Now, what if the key to unlocking some of your earliest memories wasn't buried deep in your mind, but in your body? Intriguing research comes from the Self and Body Lab at Anglia Ruskin University. Professor of Cognitive Neuroscience from there, Professor Jane Aspel, is here to tell us all about it. Welcome to the program, Jane. Before you tell us about what you did in this really interesting study, maybe you might set out the challenge. What is it you're trying to understand?
So we wanted to find out whether there was an interaction between the body and memories, and between the self and memories. And I think anybody could understand that that might be the case, because obviously any memory that you have about your life is a memory about yourself. So the self is always involved. And also, and this is something that hasn't really been researched before, perhaps surprisingly, of course, if you think about any experience that you ever have and any memory that you have, you usually think about perhaps what you see, what you feel, what you smell, what you hear. But what is often not thought about is the fact that your body is always present. So every experience we ever have, we have an experience of our body included in that. So what the body is like at that moment in time. And so any memory that we have should include some encoding of the particular state of our body at the time of that experience. But that hasn't really been investigated. So we wanted to see if we could find a link between those two things, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about the five senses a lot of the time, but proprioception, our sense of our body, is rarely discussed in this way. But it's such an important part of how we perceive ourselves and how we perceive the world, right? And those people who have lost a limb very much lose a very significant sense, and that is a huge deficit for those people. So, I sometimes do things for Science Week, and I've did this rubber hand illusion. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it. So this, the idea behind it is that you you give people the sense that a rubber hand is their hand by sort of hiding their hand and then you're kind of stroking both of the hands in the same way, the fake hand and the real hand. And you can actually trick people into thinking that a fake hand is theirs. And so this can also be done with our bodies, right? That we can actually trick people into thinking that their body is a different shape or someone else's body. Maybe you might talk to us a little bit about that to help us segue into this idea of your experiment.
Yeah, the rubber hand illusion is the best known example of those types of illusions, which show how plastic our brains are, in a sense, in terms of our brains are quite willing to accept even a rubber hand, which doesn't even look especially lifelike, as being part of our body. There's also studies that I've done and other labs have done where you can trick people into the experience that a mannequin is their own body or a virtual avatar is their own body. So the brain is
surprisingly, they really feel it, right?
Yeah, it's a really strong feeling. So this has been done hundreds of times, you know, and replicated in hundreds of different labs over many years now. I think because the brain has to figure out essentially what part of the world is me. And we just take it for granted. We open our eyes and we just know that. But actually, that is a computation that our brain has to perform based on all the sensory input it receives from the body and also from the external world. And that's not a trivial thing for the brain to do. And it doesn't just sort of do it once when you're a baby and that's sorted. In fact, it has to do it at every moment. Every moment that you're conscious, the brain is receiving all this information from the world, from the body, and it has to figure out what part of that information is related to me and where is that boundary between my body, myself, and the rest of the world. And so because of that continuous sort of dynamic computation that's happening, it's possible to trick the brain into accepting something that's not me as being me, for example, a rubber hand or a mannequin.
Yeah, which is, I've both experienced this and seen people experience it. And it's really funny because it totally shatters your illusion of yourself in a way very, very quickly. You realize that our brain is perceiving the world and all of that perception is happening in the brain. And actually you can mess around with the inputs and the brain still has to try and make sense of that. So with that in mind, you might talk to us about the study that you were looking at, which was using Snapchat filters to try and change how people perceive themselves with a view to understanding how it might improve memory.
Yeah, so we use something called the effacement illusion, which is related to the rubber hand illusion. That's the same kind of principle. So it's a way of tricking the brain that something that you see is part of yourself. So in this case, rather than tricking the brain into accepting a rubber hand as being part of your own body, we are tricking the brain into accepting a face as being part of your body. So just as when you look in the mirror, your brain understands that you're looking at yourself because there is that congruency between, you know, what you feel, you know, if you wink or you smile or you move your head and you see the same thing happening in the mirror, then that is information the brain uses to know, okay, that's me in the mirror.
And these Snapchat filters became huge in the during COVID, right? Because they were a fun distraction and they just suddenly started to get quite good and quite convincing.
Yeah, that's right. So, they're still really fun. I've got a teenage daughter who uses them, you know, to send funny photos to her friends. So, obviously, these filters can, you know, make you look like a cat or make you look like the ones last week for Halloween. So it can change your face in various ways. And it can change not just a photo, but actually a video image as well. So what we made use of this. We actually did the experiment during lockdown. So we did the experiment with participants who were online using Zoom. And what we wanted to do was to make them feel that they had the body of a child again by means of an effacement illusion, which made them feel that they had the face of a child in particular. So one of the Snapchat filters called the baby filter, it changes your face so as to look very childlike. So it makes the eyes bigger, the nose smaller, the cheeks sort of chubbier. So it's quite effective. It makes you look like you did as a child. And then because you're looking at a video, so we set up a Zoom call, they put the filter on. So instead of seeing their face as it looks normally, they would see their face on the self screen as it looked in a sort of childlike version. And then because it was a video, every time they moved their head or blinked or anything, obviously the video would do the same thing. So it was like looking at a mirror, but instead of seeing your adult current face, you were seeing your face as it looked when you were a child.
So what did you find? How did the experiment work and what were you hoping to understand?
So what we predicted was that because when you were a child, obviously you had a different body and a different face, and we expect that that different body and that different face was encoded as part of your childhood memories. So we were predicting that if a participant experienced this illusion of having their childlike face again and seeing it in a mirror, so not just looking at a photograph, but seeing the face move, so to trick your brain into this experience that you had that face again, then that might facilitate and improve your ability to access memories from your childhood.
So the idea is that if you could sort of see yourself as you were, as you started to talk and move, that that might remind you of what it was like to be that person. And then through that, you might be able to access deeper memories from your past.
Yeah. So and the idea that it would be more effective than just looking at a photograph, because the movement is the crucial thing here. So it's one thing just looking, you know, obviously, if you just look at a rubber hand, you're not going to feel like it's part of your body, but you need that synchrony of feeling the touch on your hand, seeing the touch on the rubber hand. So in this case, we had the synchrony of seeing the face on the screen that moves exactly in synchrony with your own face as you move from side to side. It moves from side to side as what you'd see in a mirror. So that then is tricking the brain into accepting that face. Not just looking at the face, but accepting that face as being your face.
So what did you find? Obviously, it's difficult to quantify how good someone's memories are and whether or not they're accurate. But you had people talk about moments from their childhood, and then those outputs were evaluated by third parties. Just talk me through the experiment itself.
Yeah, so there are ways of quantifying that. There's obviously a huge amount of memory research that has taken place over the years. And there's something called an autobiographical memory interview, which is a particular protocol to assess the richness of somebody's memory.
Right.
So you follow particular questions and a particular sequence of questions. And so what we did was we had two groups of participants. One of them were experienced 90 seconds of this illusion where they saw their own face as it looks currently. And then the other group were experiencing 90 seconds of having their childhood type face. And then after those 90 seconds, we asked each participant questions about childhood memories or recent memories following this autobiographical memory interview. So we asked them simply to explain for up to 5 minutes, to describe a memory from their childhood from aged 11 or under in as much detail as possible. So everything that they could possibly remember. And it needed to be a memory that they had personally experienced, not something, you know, that their parents had told them or they'd seen in a photograph. So an episodic memory where you can really, in a sense, relive the thing that happened. So we recorded that description that they provided of the memory. And then what you can do is have independent raters who are blind to the condition that the participant was in. So they're not biased. And then they have to rate and code the memory for the amount of detail and specific detail, the amount of richness in each of these memories, so you can quantify it.
And so what did you find?
So we did find what we predicted. So the people who had experienced this illusion of having the childhood face again were able to recall significantly more detailed memories from their childhood. We didn't find any effect on recent memories. So it was specific to childhood memories. So it seems that this illusion does facilitate and improve access to those childhood memories.
This is quite exciting in a way, because you could use this technology to actually make that experience even richer, right? I mean, new AI technologies could actually create a much richer version of yourself with all of the details of your school and the background, and you could really create a very rich world in which someone could reenact their childhood, which could make this experience even better.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the filter we used was actually a really basic Snapchat filter. But I could imagine, I don't know if it's possible already, but with AI, you could, you know, give it a photograph of you as a child, and then AI could create a video of what you looked like as a child that would be incredibly realistic, a sort of deep fake video that then would move in synchrony with your own face. And that would be, I think that would boost the effect even more, that you would be able to recall even more detail. And you could use it not just from childhood, but for example, you could test people perhaps in their 70s or 80s, get a photo of them when they were 30 or 40 and see if that facilitated them remembering events from that time period of life.
Yeah. In terms of verifying that what they're saying is accurate and actually happened, have there been any long-term studies of this protocol where certain events were created and then 5 years later they were tested on their memories of that? Is, or how do you, because obviously memory and understanding and even just understanding how an event happened, we know that, you know, witnessing crimes, they can, that testimony can be unreliable. How do you really understand whether or not what someone remembers is actually what happened?
Yeah, I mean, we didn't try and do that in our study because that would have obviously involved a huge amount of work of contacting the person's parents or something like that to have a sort of independent witness. And as you say, people remember different things. All the eyewitness memory studies show that. So we didn't try to verify it. I mean, there have been memory studies, I think, which have, you know, do go down the approach of verifying rather than just measuring richness. So I can't say that they were necessarily more accurate, but they certainly felt that they were able to remember more detail subjectively.
Yeah, God, I would love to try that for myself because it's something that I really struggle with. My memory is very poor. I have only the flashes. Maybe my brain has blocked them out on purpose, Jane. Maybe that's what it is. My brain is like, you do not want to remember this. But my memory is really, really poor. And I think understanding how we might be able to get a richer, more detailed memory of our childhood or times gone past is a really, really interesting and this area. And this is such an exciting potential. Thank you so much for joining us on the program.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure to speak to you.
That's an interesting one. If you've ever had an opportunity to experience the rubber hand illusion, it's not hard to do. You can Google a video on how to do it. It feels weird. And the idea that it doesn't have to be a hand, it could be a chicken leg. It's just, it gives you this whole new perspective of what it is to be yourself. I highly recommend, if you're bored on a Sunday, you've got kids, give it a go. You don't need kids, but they get a real kick out of it. Okay, time to look at some of your comments from last week. We were talking about how to avoid getting tears when you cut onions, and research seems to show that if you've got a sharp knife and you cut slowly, you get a lot less of those molecules going into your eyes, which cause this reaction. Noel from the Kingdom says, I blow gently towards the onion when chopping as if blowing away cigarette smokes. Works every time. Yeah, I guess that should work. We're talking about, you know, volatile chemicals. If they're going in a direction, blowing them away from your eyes should work. We talked to Anna Angelova Volponi from King's College last week about growing teeth in the lab. And Laura says, I'd love a set of lab grown teeth, to be honest. I have a lot of fillings from when I was a kid, the black ones. I asked the dentist about covering up the fillings with white, but because they're made of different materials, they can't do that. They're great to hear so much progress being made in the area of science. Really enjoyed the piece on hairy toothpaste. Okay, very interesting. Our dental pieces, Laura. That's awful. I didn't know that you couldn't cover up black fillings. And that is frustrating. And I have a few fillings, but I'm delighted that I managed to get white ones because I didn't know that once they were black from decades ago that you couldn't fix that. Someone says, what are the remaining major hurdles before this could become a routine treatment in dental practice and regulatory approval? So, you know, when we're talking about growing lab-grown teeth, as you heard me speak kind of skeptically about the research, there's so much to think about. So Anna Angelona Volponi is working on the various stages of producing this, but figuring out how to protect this tooth as it grows, you know, the immunological response, ensuring that it grows in a way that's safe and isn't cancerous. You know, whenever you're dealing with, you know, growing of any sort of cells, that's a concern that, that it might cause tumors. Like, there's so much to cover here. I feel like growing teeth and then just putting them into your jaw is quite far away from speaking to Anna. But once you get there, I suppose the regulatory hurdles are the same for any medicine. You know, you have to prove that it's not only works, that it's better than what's available, and that it doesn't have drastic side effects. So, you know, I feel like we're very far away from that point right now. It was very much a cutting edge, frontier, blue sky science piece. That's it from us on this week's episode. Thanks to Maurice O'Sullivan, Rory Galvin, and Hugo da Silva Scott on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.
We've all done it. Stock our fridge with leafy greens and good intentions, only to have our future self sacrifice quality nutrition for the convenience of takeout. Keep your body and mind nourished all day with a whole body meal shake from Kachava. It's got 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. But the best part? It actually tastes delicious. With 6 indulgent flavors to choose from, it's easy to make a superfood packed shake. From chocolate, vanilla, and chai, to matcha, coconut acai, and strawberry, you've got endless ways to personalize your Kachava. Whether you prefer it straight up or enjoy adding fruit, peanut butter, nut milk, or even iced coffee, with every 2 scoops of Kachava, you're getting 85 plus superfoods, nutrients, and plant-based ingredients. Shop now through December 2nd to get 30% off your first purchase of 2 or more bags with code FITNESS at Kachava.com. That's 30% off for a limited time at kachava.com code FITNESS.